track.
I'm Dick Gordon. This is The Connection. It's all Thomas Jefferson's fault. He killed the railroads before they were born. His radical agrarian ideology laid the groundwork for Henry Ford's mission to move people around the country in Model Ts. Well, that's one theory. Another one is that American railroads were doomed from the start due to the corrupt business approach of the robber baron railroad executives. Either way, during the 20th century, America evolved into a car culture. And passenger railroads have struggled and still struggle for survival. In a 1970 attempt to save the rails, Congress formed the National Railroad Passenger Corporation, Amtrak, which has been pulling a very heavy load ever since. While the Japanese and the Europeans launched high-tech, high-speed trains, Amtrak fought for funding in a sprawling nation married to highways and skyways. Amtrak's high-speed Acela train debuted in December 2000 and has enjoyed some moderate success, but nothing compared to the TGV or the bullet train. And just last week, Amtrak Chief Executive Officer George Warrington cautioned Congress that Amtrak needs over $1 billion or its sayonara city of New Orleans. Connection listeners, is the sun finally setting on passenger trains in America? Can a nation so dependent on planes and automobiles make room for a modern rail system? We'd like you to join us. Call 1-800-423-8255. 1-800-423-TALK. I'm joined in the studio this hour by Jim Motovalli. He's the editor of E, the environmental magazine, and author of Breaking Gridlock, Moving Toward Transportation That Works. And Jonathan Richmond, who's a transportation expert, consultant, and author of The Private Provision of Public Transport. I'm also joined on the phone by Nancy Connery. She's a transportation consultant and a member of the Amtrak Reform Council, which yesterday released its report to Congress. And Nancy, if I can begin with you, if I understand the basics in the report, it's, look, let's not working now, let's break it up and look at privatizing Amtrak.
That's one step of the process. But, you know, the most important thing is that we could get beyond just the survival of Amtrak and start talking seriously as a government, as the United States government, about what the future of passenger rail is. We already have the strongest freight rail system in the entire world by far and away. But our passenger rail has clearly suffered, in part because it was set up to fail. And its privatization is a possibility a little bit further down the line. But right now, we start to have to start with policy and then start putting a bright light on the numbers in passenger rail, what it really costs to provide service, both in the infrastructure of the Northeast Corridor and then through the high-speed corridors around the country and then, of course, the connecting dots.
The former Governor Michael Dukakis is chairman of Amtrak. He's also joining us on the line. Mr. Dukakis, doesn't sound very good for Amtrak.
Well, I don't agree with that. I think we're poised for what could be a great new era in rail passenger service. The Acela, Dick, is not enjoying moderate success. It's going gangbusters. We're carrying 10,000 people a day during your typical business day on the new Acela Expresses, and that's just the beginning of much greater growth. I'm out here in California during the winter. The fastest growing rail corridor in America is the Capital Corridor between San Jose and Sacramento. What it tells you is that when we get the capital to invest, we do the job and we do it well. And
hang on, now
the sellers all over the country.
This Reform Council says the money that you're getting is being badly spent. What Amtrak needs is the sort of accountability of private business.
Well, I don't know what they're talking about. They have never, in the 3 years of their existence, recommended specifically to us, to the best of my knowledge, maybe Nancy knows something I don't know, specific steps to make us more efficient. We've got McKinsey and Company, the well-known business consultants, climbing all over the operation. We just voted $170 million in additional cuts, and that's one of several rounds of efficiency and cost-cutting moves that we've made. And in those parts of the country where we have committed serious capital, the Northeast, California, we're doing terrifically well. Now, what does that tell you? Well, the first thing it tells you is don't break the thing up. That's absurd. I mean, the council has recommended not one government agency, but three. You know, somebody said the other day, if you don't like Amtrak, why create three of them? And secondly, don't take our responsibility for the infrastructure in the Northeast Corridor away from us. That's the place where we're doing best. We're going to make $150 to $200 million worth of operating profit this year on the Northeast Corridor alone. Why in heaven's name would you propose a breakup of that system?
Nancy Connery, well, Congress put you in charge of doing a thorough review of Amtrak, and the man in charge of Amtrak right now says you got it all wrong.
Well, I have to say, Governor Dukakis, in all due respect, the Amtrak has not dealt seriously with any of the proposals that we've made all the way along the this process. For the last 4 years, we've had to pull numbers out of them, kicking and screaming, and mostly we haven't been able to get them to respond because, in fact, it's a kind of like a great big box into which Congress pours money and hopes something comes out. But Amtrak itself is whipsawed by a lot of competing political priorities. What we're asking is not that we're breaking it up into a lot of government agencies. We're asking that, we first of all start with a government agency that sets policy. Amtrak cannot both be a commercial enterprise and a government policy-setting enterprise. And it tries to do both right now, and I'm afraid it doesn't work. What we've asked also is that we set up a special company that will be accountable for the Northeast Corridor. Amtrak would still run on it for now. And just as it does right now. And so it's really the question of that corridor and its condition, which you know is very, very bad. And in fact, it deserves a lot more serious attention than it's ever got under Amtrak, of course, who has to has a lot of competing priorities. Amtrak is a relatively small user of the corridor. Mostly it's commuter rail services that run up and down, you know, thousands of trains every day, and Amtrak is just a few hundred. So the question is, how do we separate that infrastructure so we know precisely what the costs are involved in that and begin to get some real accountability there? And then the operations, Amtrak would continue to run just as they are now, but eventually on a careful, carefully prescribed basis, competition would be introduced.
Governor Dukakis, it sounds like you've got more of a political argument on your hands than you do a financial argument.
Well, I'm not sure Nancy's making a political argument. I mean, she's suggesting that we can have a better national rail passenger system if we break up Amtrak into, as I understand it, three different corporations. We take our responsibility for the Northeast Corridor away from us and give it to somebody else. Of course, we know, Dick, what happens when you do that. The one problem we have in the Northeast Corridor is between New Haven and New York, where we don't own the right-of-way. It's owned by a bi-state corporation, Metro North, and we have to slow 150-mile-an-hour trains down to about 50 miles an hour because they haven't done the job and the overhead electrical system hasn't been overhauled in about 80 years. Now, if that's the model that Nancy and her colleagues think is going to work, based on our experience, then I don't comprehend what they're talking about. And if it's Britain that they're talking about, which of course privatized its system several years ago and is a total disaster, it seems to me that's the last thing in the world we need. Look, give Amtrak the capital investment we need for rail and we'll do the job. We're doing it in the Northeast, we're doing it in California, and we should have a sellers all over the country.
Governor, thank you very much. Governor Michael Dukakis is chairman of Amtrak. To the studio now, where Jim Motovelli is sitting with me. He's editor of the Environmental Magazine and Breaking Gridlock, Moving Towards Transportation That Works. Jonathan Richmond's a transportation expert, author of The Private Provision of Public Transport. Gentlemen, this argument sound a little bit familiar to you?
Well, I totally agree with Governor Dukakis. We need a sell of trains all across the country. There's a lot of enthusiasm for it. For instance, the California High-Speed Rail Authority says that a high-speed train system would return twice as many benefits to the state's citizens as it costs. There are similar consortiums in the Southeast. They want high-speed rail. Acela is basically making a profit, if you look at it in one way. There's different ways of looking at it. But according to the New York Times this morning, it makes $19 per passenger. That part of the system is working. And as I argue in my book, Breaking Gridlock, we need fast, competitive transit to compete with the private car and the airplane. And essentially, Amtrak service is up 40% since September 11th because people are looking for alternative methods of transportation.
Sounds like we should be on the train, Jonathan. Is it that
well,
simple?
That's not the only thing we ought to be discussing. I'm afraid I disagree with both parties, and this is not going to make for a useful conversation, basically having Amtrak arguing that it needs to stay in existence and basically a conservative quasi-think tank setting itself up with an ideological position that it wants to go to privatization.
You're saying the Amtrak Reform Council came at this with a strong determination to
They have come with a right-wing ideology. It is a flawed report. It is not helpful to the discussion. There are some helpful points in it, but overall it is not a calm, collected, unbiased analysis. However, they make a number of good points, and Mr. Dukakis brings out a key one. He says, look to the success of the San Jose-Sacramento corridor. Why is that a success? It's in spite of Amtrak, not because of Amtrak. It's because California has set up a very effective office. It's because the state of California has poured large amounts of resources into making that corridor work. They were frustrated for decades with Amtrak's neglect of that corridor, and the only way they could do something was to put their own money in and to put their own management team in. So this does underline the point of the report that some sort of change is needed because Amtrak is not effective at providing for those sorts of consumer needs. But the report then goes and advocates another flawed structure. One of the problems with Amtrak is it's a national structure, whereas most of the demands are regional. Most people are not going cross-country anymore. We're talking about the need for effective services over relatively short distances. They're calling for this new national government agency. It's going to be a small agency, but nonetheless, it's to be in charge of coordination. Well, it's going to be just as liable to political manipulation as Amtrak is today, and it isn't going to have a chance at rationalizing.
Nancy Jonathan saying that people on this Amtrak Reform Council had their minds made up before the report was written.
No, as a matter of fact, I will assure you that this was a very rambunctious group right throughout this process. It represents as far a broad a political spectrum as you could get. Nine of us, including three very solid Democrats, came to the table at the end. But it was, I think we gave Amtrak the benefit of the doubt as long as we could until it was really clear that they were going to, hit the wall financially. And so we went forward with an idea that, in fact, I don't disagree. The regional corridors are really one of the success stories. And we talk to people throughout the country, and particularly in those western corridors as well as in the Midwest. They would love to have an option besides Amtrak. You don't just, jump into privatization, and we are certainly not proposing the British model. That was a very different system, but tens of thousands of trains all over the world right now are being operated by private operators under, some kind of federal control and oversight, and oftentimes with federal capital.
Well, and oftentimes with a lot of assistance from the government, Nancy. Look at the budget for 2003, you're looking at $24 billion for highways, $14 billion for the FAA, and like $700 million for Federal Railroad Administration.
Yeah, but look at the numbers of people who are on those systems. You have over 600 million on the airplanes. You've got countless, billions on the highways, and they're all paying user fees to support that system. We obviously need a much more secure and stable source of funding.
And Jim, if the money was put into the rails, would that change?
I think it would make a big difference. One of the reasons that ridership is not up is it's relatively expensive to ride the high-speed rail. It's not really price competitive with flying. I think, and I argue this in my book, you have to make them not only speed competitive but price competitive. And by demanding that Amtrak be essentially a pay-as-you-go service, it's forced Amtrak to raise prices to where it's not really competitive. It becomes more of a luxury service.
I agree with that. I think one of the flaws of the whole Amtrak experiment is the separation of capital and operating expenditures. So you've had billions of dollars put into the Northeast Corridor, and now Amtrak is told to make this false profit on a small part at the top of the equation. And what you're seeing is a relatively low capacity Acela system that is priced far too high for ordinary people to use, and I think that's a problem.
Connection listeners, do you ride the trains regularly or as a summer treat? Should we have more of them? Should the federal government be putting more money into a national rail service or a regional rail service? Our number is 1-800-423-8255. We invite you to join us on The Connection on National Public Radio. listening to The Connection on National Public Radio. My name's Dick Gordon. This hour we're talking about trains. Our telephone number is 1-800-423-8255. My guests are Nancy Connery. She's a transportation consultant and a member of the Amtrak Reform Council, which has just released a report suggesting that Amtrak is not working, and perhaps the best future for the company would be to break it up and deal with it in the nationwide corporation and a Northeast corridor. I'm also with Jim Motovalli. He is the editor of E, the environmental magazine, and his book is called Breaking Gridlock, Moving Towards Transportation That Works. Jonathan Richmond is also here. He's a transportation expert and author of The Private Provision of Public Transport. I'll start there, Jonathan. The private provision of public transport. If, as Jim is saying, people don't ride the rails because it's too expensive, isn't that missing the whole point of what rail travel should be or could be?
Well, the problem is a huge amount of public investment has been put into the system, and I think some sort of return is required. So you need some sort of planning for public objectives, and I don't think we've had that. The problem with privatization is if you look
planning at... Planning for public objectives, you
well,
mean...
Well, you need to say, why do we want people riding trains? Where can it make a contribution? It can make a contribution in certain isolated regional corridors where it can take enough of the traffic to make a difference. It's not going to make a difference in two-day journeys across the country. That's why you need to regionalize it and let the states take responsibility for prioritizing their resources in the way that they think is best.
And
privatization.
Go ahead. Just...
Yeah, I'm saying privatization is not the way to go because the companies are going to take an artificial look only at the immediate bottom line, at bringing in as much revenue as possible. That privatization could, in fact, be a case for limiting service, and that's what Acela is actually about. Acela is a low-capacity system designed to be high-profit and to cover its immediate incremental costs. So an opportunity has been lost to have a much larger-scale mass-market type of operation. I'd be interested to hear what the callers think. I don't think most people can afford to pay $120 one way to go from Boston to New York.
Nancy Connery, did you folks look at this when you looked at the whole future of Amtrak? Who's riding the train? Who ought to be riding the train? Why people ride the train?
Sure. And in fact, we know a lot more would like to, and I would agree. I think the Acela is very expensive, and part of the problem is that the Amtrak has not set up a system to draw in people at differing prices. Just like you have yield management on airlines, you can get more people on those planes if you can, you know, drop the cost when those trains are empty. I mean, when those planes are empty, we don't have such a system right now with Amtrak, and we should. In fact, the idea is to put a lot more people on that corridor. The major constraining focus right there is the infrastructure. That train simply can't go very fast because the infrastructure, the track between Boston and Washington, at least particularly in the southern end of it, is in such dreadful shape. And that requires obviously a lot more capital investment, which is going to have to, you know, be sorted out by both the federal government and the states involved.
Our telephone number is 1-800-423-8255. We're going to South Boston. Gary's joining us. Hi, Gary.
Hi. How you doing?
Good, thanks.
First of all, for purposes of full disclosure, I am an unabashed aficionado of train riding.
You like the old trains? You like the new trains? You just like all trains?
I like the new trains.
Bullet trains,
and
Shinkansen.
I like the old trains. I was brought up on them as a kid. But basically, I have a remark to make. I think that there are certain people that are trying to tinker around with the way these trains are being run, and they have a certain historical amnesia. Hello?
Yeah, go ahead.
And I seem to recall that the reason Amtrak came into being in the first place was because private railroad companies were a disaster to the point where CEOs were actually going to jail over this stuff, over mismanagement. And I want to know that after 30 years of quasi-government tinkering with the results that we're now talking about on this TV, on this radio program,
yeah.
I want to know what guarantees why is privatization going to work this time?
Or is privatization?
When it didn't the last time.
All right. Jim Motovalli.
I think it's very unlikely that Amtrak is going to get privatized. I think this plan is just sort of a talking point. And if you look at the agenda of certain think tanks, right-wing think tanks in the United States, they've been talking about breaking up Amtrak for a long time, and this sort of fulfills what they've been talking about. I just saw a Cato Institute report that recommends pretty much the same kind of things we're talking about here. I think a problem is there is no political constituency in Congress for rail the same way there is for highways. And you can look in the paper this morning, and there's a bipartisan spirit
of defending the cuts in the highway budget that the president has proposed. It's like a 26% cut. And on both sides of the aisle, they're out defending their pork barrel projects for highways. There isn't the same kind of thing for rail. There needs to be. Rail people need to develop more political savvy. I guess that would be one way of looking at it. But the highway lobby is the most powerful lobby in America, and we need a rail lobby like it.
Well, I disagree with that. I think we need a lobby for efficient transportation. I don't think we need to divide along separate modal lines. And I think one of the biggest problems with Amtrak is that there has been a powerful lobby for a national system, and you've had lobby groups in every congressional district maintaining services that virtually nobody use. You know, they go through Montana at 3 a.m. and at the same time, you haven't had adequate development of services where it does make sense. But to respond to the caller, what is being proposed here is not actually the same as what you had before. You're not going to have private railroads that operate freight service and have an interest in getting rid of Amtrak. We're talking about contracting, so there's some protection there. But I do have to agree that it's a very dangerous precedent. Separating operations and infrastructure could be very troublesome, as has been discovered in England. You lose responsibility for putting the infrastructure in place. I remember very well when I was teaching at the University of Reading in England a few years ago. I brought a group of my students to London for the day, and we came on the train, and we were terribly late, and there was just complete chaos. And at Paddington Station, I asked one of the rail operator people what was going on. He blamed it on rail track. So basically, when you have these separations, you blame it on the other part, you lose coordination, and you get not only poor service, but as we've seen in Britain, some terrible accidents going on. I really don't think we should follow that model.
Nancy Connery, Jim's suggesting that the report that you've put out is more of a talking point, a way of beginning the conversation on what the future of Amtrak should be.
Well, that's actually right, because in fact the reauthorization of Amtrak is just beginning, and we had no illusion that it would simply
The reauthorization specifically,
that means,
Nancy?
That the money that the Amtrak gets comes in a 6-year tranche or form that has to be renewed every 6 years. And so we're beginning that discussion again. You know, how much are they going to get in the future for the next 6 years, under what terms? I would like to go back to that point about intermodal, meaning, you know, how does the system work as a whole, which I think is really important, and we do speak of that in our report, that some of the most promising places for rail service are connecting cities to airports and perhaps city pairs, so that you can, instead of having to build new runways or new airports, you can actually get people between places a lot more efficiently. And instead of just looking at rail service as rail service in a vacuum, to think of it as a part of a much bigger system. And I think that's a critical part of our future. We can't keep building any more highways and airports in many parts of this country, particularly in the Northeast. So rail becomes an adjunct to that.
Our number is 1-800-423-8255. Gary, thanks for your call. We're going to Needham, Massachusetts, and Mike's joining us. Hi, Mike.
Hi, Dick.
Yeah, hi. Go ahead.
I can't believe you haven't mentioned the 800-pound gorilla in the living room, and that's the unions. Just recently here in the Boston area, they wanted to privatize the maintenance of the rolling stock. Well, former Congressman Joe Moakley made sure that there would be never would be any bid contract to privatize the maintenance. I mean, these guys make huge money, and they're trying to privatize and get some realism in their compensation. But until you crack down on the unions, you can never get any sort of profit on the railroads.
The union said in the union representative on the Reform Council refused to sign on the final report, saying this notion of privatizing it was just a classic way of allowing people to come in, cherry pick the best routes, and leave everyone else without rail service. What would you say to him, Mike?
Well, what I would say to him then is that we know we can save millions and millions and millions of dollars by privatizing, by getting some efficiency in the maintenance of the rolling stock. And again, this is all political. Congressman Moakley just absolutely killed this contract here in the Boston area when they wanted to privatize the maintenance, but it never happened. And now we've got this expensive maintenance systems that can never get rid of.
Nancy Connery, just
you've never mentioned it.
How political is this, Nancy?
Oh, it's all extremely political. But you know, even though we're supposedly a right-wing ideological group, the council as a whole endorsed the idea that the unions deserve fair wages, and that skilled workers are a critical part of this, the potential salvation. And if indeed these routes, some of the routes are privatized or offered to, you know, private competition, that, you know, union workers would continue the same, pretty much the same conditions that they have now. Because, in fact, we believe that they are not the problem. The efficiencies in the system have to do with the overhead, the overall operations, and that ultimately the private contractors around the world have, in most cases, taken union contracts as a given. And, in fact, it is not that. It is not the deal breaker that it would be seen to be by from the outside.
Well, let me. Can I just say, if that's a given, then let the Amtrak fail.
Well, in fact, the union representative was the one person who wrote a major dissent
right.
to the report and rejected it. And he has some quite eloquent things to say about the disasters you've had when you have had privatization, which has separated operations from infrastructure. My own studies of a whole series of transit privatizations across the United States in public transit rather than in railroads shows that this can also be subject to a lot of problems. You get low wages, you also get much higher turnover in labor, less reliability in labor, and also part of it, if you're going to have someone holding a franchise for only 3 or 4 years, they're not dedicated to the future of that infrastructure, and the infrastructure deteriorates. That is what has caused a lot of the problems in Britain. So actually, we have examples in both Britain and the states where uncoordinated privatization doesn't work. What we need instead is to give the states much more control to decide how to spend their money. We need to remove a national structure when it makes no sense and go for rational services where they're needed.
I just wanted to say that privatization is how we went from 300,000 miles of rail track in America to 150,000 today, and also how we lost our nationwide trolley service. It's great to see trolleys in Boston, but we've lost them in most of the cities in America. But I did want to agree with Nancy when she talked about intermodality, and New York is a great example of a total lack of that. The New York airports do not connect to public transit. You cannot get on a train at the airports, and that causes a lot of congestion in New York.
But let's go back to Mike's point about the unions, because you've got, as a political lobby group, unions saying that we need to support interstate trucking. You've got unions saying we need to support the people who are working on the rails. And that debate goes round and round, and the future of rail simply gets caught on that, doesn't it?
Yes. Unions are going to look at their own short-term interests. I think that's pretty apparent.
You know, and you also have to look at the fact that the unions are not of one voice. Charlie Moneypenny represents one group of workers. There's a much larger group of workers, another union, the UTU, that is actually very much receptive to the idea of some major changes in the way in which Amtrak is organized. And so I think, you know, there's some division there. But I'd like to step back to that point you just made earlier regarding the state involvement. And I think that's a really important one. I have no disagreement with that. If the states, in fact, the states are several of them are willing, have already shown their demonstrated their willingness to step up to the plate in the West and the Southeast and also in the Midwest. They're actually spending their own money, and they plan to do a lot more of it because they see the fact that this is something that they need to plan for themselves and are essentially showing the way.
Mike, thanks a lot for your call. We're going to Durham, North Carolina. Tony's joining us now. Hi, Tony.
Hello.
Go ahead.
My question, first of all, I spent some time in Asia, have used Japan's rail system, found it to be quite efficient and affordable. But when I come home, I don't even think about using our rail system. So once you resolved all of the business of America's rail system, how would you address culturally adjusting the people to use it? I think it's really a difference of our culture doesn't even consider using the rail system.
Well, tell me about your case, Tony, because you're saying you come back to the United States and you don't even think about getting on a train. Why?
Well, of course, in the South, we don't really have an advanced rail system. They're trying to make some efforts of a rail system in the Raleigh-Durham area, but that's, you know, many years away.
But what
so
you're
we
saying,
don't have access.
Sorry, but what you're saying beyond that is that even if it was there, you'd be more inclined to get in your car.
Probably so. I think when I travel abroad, there are adventures, and I was doing business in Japan, so when I wanted to get out of the city, I would hop on the train system that was very efficient, very on time, very affordable. So I see it as a cultural difference between America and other parts of the world where we don't consider using the rail system. So how would
Right.
we work toward changing our attitude about the rail
system. Jim Motovalli.
You have to start from where we are. We're the most car-dependent society in the world. We're 98% car-dependent. If you look at commuter travel, we don't think about the trains, as you said, as they do in Asia and in Europe. And we have to try to make the trains, and this is what I stress very much in my book, we have to make them competitive. We have to have routes like the Acela route. We have to have high-speed rail. We have to have corridor-related bus travel. It's not just trains. There's lots of other things.
But what
we
are you
do.
Suggesting that be done, that we put, you know, ads on the side of buses saying don't ride the bus, ride the train? What's the change that you're suggesting?
I'm suggesting what we need are dedicated bus corridors, so where the buses can travel in their own lane and become like a train service where you can have on-time service. You have to make the service as fast as driving to work is for most people, because if it's three times slower, and I've done a lot of transit ridership where it is three times slower, mm-hmm. people just won't take it in America. And let me just say, by the way, that our caller, the Southeast High-Speed Rail Corridor, which connects, is intended to connect right to where she lives, and that may be in place by 2010.
Maybe.
Maybe.
I disagree about the cultural issue. I think we need to look at the geographical facts, how Americans are distributed, how they live, what their work needs are, what their travel needs are. I would advise the state of North Carolina not to put a penny into a rail system, because a rail system is never going to make sense in North Carolina. You have a dispersed population. You're never going to have the demand. It is not an appropriate way to meet it. I think what we do need to do is to put it on that state basis so that states can decide how they want to spend their own money and look at the purposes. Rail makes sense in the Northeast Corridor. It makes sense in very few other places. As we're mentioning the bus, though, I do think we do need to talk about some of the bus operators, because they're some of the real heroes around here, and they're not mentioned. We have Greyhound Bus. We have in Massachusetts Peter Pan Bus that carries a huge volume of passengers and doesn't get public subsidy. They're carrying people who don't have much money and who need an effective way to travel. Amtrak doesn't serve that market, and I think we can draw a lot of lessons from what the bus operators are doing, and I think
even though they are getting the subsidy dollars.
The bus operators are not getting...
No, Amtrak. I'm saying
even
Amtrak.
Even though Amtrak is getting the subsidy dollars, their service is too expensive for most people to use. When Acela started, I did a round trip to New Haven. I wanted to ride on Acela, and I went on Acela, and it cost $75 one way from Boston, and I came back on the Peter Pan bus. I think it was $35 or something. And I can tell you that the Peter Pan bus was full of older people. It was packed with students. It plays a major role in getting kids to the Western Massachusetts colleges, and it serves a huge number of points. Amtrak serves a very small amount of points, it takes a huge subsidy, and it doesn't provide a service that most people can afford. So we do need to beef up bus operations, and one advantage of putting it on a state basis is the states can then coordinate between how bus service might need to be supplemented, perhaps using more buses.
Okay, Connection listeners, we started out by talking about trains, now we're talking about buses. Is that where the conversation really ought to be, given the fact that we have highways going just about everywhere? You know our telephone number. It's 1-800-423-8255, 1-800-423-TALK. Your thoughts on the future of rail travel in this country. Thanks to Tony for your call, and my name is Dick Gordon. This is The Connection on National Public Radio. You're listening to The Connection on National Public Radio. My name's Dick Gordon. We're talking about trains. I think we're talking about trains. Got a little sidetracked a little earlier on buses, and that may be part of our conversation. My guests are Jim Motovalli and Jonathan Richmond. They're with me in the studio. Nancy Connery is a member of the Amtrak Reform Council, which recently recommended that whatever Amtrak is now, it ought not to be, because it's not working. Nancy, when this conversation takes place, it always heads overseas. We always end up talking about the TGV in France and the Shinkansen in Japan and all the places where bullet trains work. Is that a useful direction for the conversation to go?
No, I don't think so. I wish it were so, but in fact, the cost of those systems are so astronomical. They require rights of way that are very different than the ones we currently have, particularly in the Northeast Corridor. They've got to be a lot straighter and a lot wider and totally separated So, you
but
know,
I, but I read last night that the TGV in France actually makes money.
Yeah, well, it does, because in fact, you know, it operates with such frequency and support, people just naturally, you know, flock to it. It becomes part of a daily life. But, you know, we could have, actually, we don't have to have 200-mile-an-hour trains to be competitive. If you could have 150-mile-an-hour trains, or plus or minus, to run reliably on the Northeast Corridor right now, it would take, I think it would attract a huge increase in ridership. And you can do that with the existing right-of-way. So it wouldn't cost so much more, but we do need to spend at least about $28 billion on that corridor to put it into good working order.
And you're saying that's a good investment or
that's
not?
That's a very good investment. In fact, it's an investment we can't really ignore any further, because you can't build any more airports, and you can't widen that highway much more anywhere along that corridor. So it becomes, you know, for the next 10 or 15 or 20 years, the most important new means of transportation that we've got.
Jonathan Mitchell.
But if it's done in the way in which the council is suggesting, in which you're separating infrastructure from operations, it's going to be a disaster. Now, there's
not true. The infrastructure right now carries mostly commuter lines. Amtrak is a relatively minor player on that Northeast Corridor.
Well, that's a false...
It owns it, but it does not take care of it very well.
That's a false premise, because the commuter trains operate relatively short distances. Amtrak is the only operator that goes over the entire length of the corridor, so I'd say that there's a strong case for that operator to be in control. Amtrak also operates a much higher speed type of dedicated operation, and it needs to be able to ensure that is properly provided for.
Well, indeed, it can. I mean, we have multiple operators right now, and indeed Amtrak would have the same rights to proceed as it does now. It doesn't necessarily need to own it as a specific company, because in fact it is always going to be whipsawed by all the political competition that it faces right now. So that Northeast Corridor is not being funded in anywhere near shape that it should, because in fact they can't do it. Let's go back to the states. As you mentioned, the states who are responsible for those commuter services really need to step to the plate and provide more support for that corridor in conjunction with the federal government.
And yet, overlying all this, Jim, is your contention that maybe this is not the right direction to go, that taking advantage of the existing highway structures and forgetting about rail travel may be a more sensible approach, or am I misreading you?
I think there are examples of some cities. Curitiba, Brazil is one. Ottawa, Canada is another. Las Vegas, believe it or not, is another. And the fourth one would be Los Angeles, where they've looked at dedicated bus corridors. You take a single lane of
existing
highway.
You're talking about buses within the cities, though.
Buses within the cities. It wouldn't have to be within the city. You could look at this as an intercity thing also. But it's worked very well, and you can ensure on-time delivery of passengers. They don't get caught in the congestion. This is the main reason people take transit, is to get out of the highway congestion. In I-95, which goes through where I live in Connecticut, the highway is three times over design capacity. You have almost permanent gridlock. And if people could be ensured that they could ride in a traffic-free bus corridor, I think they would take it. The main reason to talk about this is the tremendous cost of building light rail systems in terms of the track. In Los Angeles, you're looking at $200 or $300 million a mile. That's a very sobering figure. Mm-hmm. That's why there is so much outcry in L.A. over the amount they've spent on the light rail as opposed to their bus service. There was a successful lawsuit against the MTA in L.A. complaining about the short shrift they gave to the buses because of how much they spent on light rail.
Our number is 1-800-423-8255. Ted's joining us from Boston. Hi, Ted.
Hi there. It's interesting to listen to this and hear so much conversation about dollars, 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 and that yet there hasn't been, and I'm a big fan of Jim's magazine, there hasn't been any mention of the environmental health impacts and as well as the safety impacts of our dependence on cars, as opposed to, you know, whether we're talking about this dedicated bus system that Jim is talking about or making the trains a real alternative to in terms of convenience and price and speed.
I did see a figure, Jim, in your book, like where you've done the math of something, 180,000 cars replaced by one train between one city. Am I right about
that?
Yeah,
I think it's very interesting. Thank you very much, caller, for pointing all this out. And if you look at one of the members of the Amtrak Reform Council, a guy named Wendell Cox, He goes around the country telling communities they shouldn't build light rail systems because it'll never pay for themselves and it has no benefit. And you have to take into account the tremendous environmental and social benefit of getting people off the roads and reducing congestion. Just about everything else we've tried to get people off the highways doesn't work. We are tremendously underutilizing rail. Even when where rail exists, and it exists in my area, we have the Metro North trains that Governor Dukakis referred to, but people don't even think of it. We're so car dependent and so car focused.
Nancy Connery, I mean, did the environmental aspect of using trains as a means of protecting the environment even come into your equation?
Of course. In fact, where you have high density populations, I think it's essential. I mean, that's become part of the equation. There is no advantage to a train that runs in low density in terms of environmental if it's running half empty.
How do you measure that, though, when you're putting together a report like this?
We didn't actually get into that kind of fine line, you know, engineering and scientific investigation. That wasn't our task. But, you know, I don't disagree that there are environmental impacts, and that's one of the reasons I believe so strongly that corridor development in high-density portions, parts of the country is very, very important for that reason, but not that reason alone. That's one of several.
I think, first of all, we need to look at the myth of this idea of dependency. We're not dependent on cars. It's a mode of choice that serves the current land uses we have in this country. We're not going to break this dependency because people's preference is going to remain for the car. And for the most part, they're actually very happy with it. I think Jim has also contradicted himself. At the first point, he said that there may not be a case for light rail because it's so expensive, and then he seems to be defending it. I think the important thing is to put this on rational grounds and look at those small, isolated cases where rail is going to make sense. And in those situations, I think we need to do it properly.
I think light rail makes a lot of sense in a lot of places. One of the real unfortunate things is trying to build a light rail system in a very densely developed city like Los Angeles. Maybe in Los Angeles, light rail was not the way to go. Maybe there, more extensive bus routes would have been better. And I think they are neglecting their buses in Los Angeles as a result of how much they've spent.
Ted, go ahead, last point to you.
I would just like to add that, you know, in reference to Wendell Cox, who does represent a kind of extreme thinking in terms of light rail, and in fact killed the light rail system in Milwaukee, Wisconsin, still the mayor of that city, who is also a member of our council, John Norquist, stood together with Wendell in terms of supporting the proposal that the Amtrak Reform Council made.
Nancy, thanks for that, and Ted, for your call to Margie, who's joining us from Lexington, Massachusetts. Margie, hi.
Hi there. Thanks. I would like to challenge one of the most repeated and most incorrect myths we have about the cost structure for rail versus things that travel on wheels on roads, like buses and cars. We hear all the time that the trains are subsidized, whereas the cars are not. This is clearly ridiculous when you look at the billions of dollars that go into supporting the federal highway system, the local roads, and so on. And so I would like your guests to address that prevailing misconception, please.
Gas taxes.
Well, it's right. Non-gas taxes.
Airline
every one of
tax.
Us pays. Every one of us pays astronomical amounts of money incrementally through our taxes for every mile that we drive to and from work in our cars. But it's as though that money didn't exist in the equation when you hear people say, rail is subsidized and cars are not. It's bullshit. Oh, excuse me.
Agreed.
Well, let me just read something from the New York Times today, and I think this is very true. This is why there's such a political constituency for highway spending and not nearly as much of a constituency for Amtrak. Building roads creates jobs, lawmakers said over and over. It also provides tidy bundles of federal cash for lawmakers to send to their home districts. That's it in a nutshell. Tidy bundles of cash to send to the home districts. And that's why there's such a road constituency.
Yeah, but that's also true for transit, and you just look at the amount of tax dollars that have gone into transit.
No, there is nothing like road paving at election time.
Come on, this is one of the finest
ways of spreading the good stuff around.
Yeah, but
and
if you
it's
look,
deeply entrenched.
Yeah, 20% of federal spending going on transit, which is, you know, 2% of usage, a lot of money being diverted from highway funds to transit. Now, I'm not a big fan of road building myself.
The highway funds are, if you just look at 1 year of highway funding, that's Amtrak going all the way back to 1971.
Yeah, but it's paid for by the people who use those highways. highways through gas taxes. And in fact, the people who use the highways have paid for a lot of transit developments through diversion of those funds to other purposes. And in some cases, that's great. But I'm simply saying that we shouldn't promote this myth that somehow highways get this great subsidy and rail systems
don't.
Well,
you're denying they get a great amount of subsidy? I mean, they obviously do.
The road systems?
Yes.
The road systems are paid for by their users through taxation.
Well, that's part of what's funding it, but there's also a great deal of federal cash that goes into it every year.
Well, it's coming out of, just as he said, it comes out of a user tax for the most part. The only part that really doesn't are the diesel fuel taxes, the heavy trucks. They impose much greater impact on those roads, and they don't really pay their way.
And obviously, if you compare the amount of gas taxes in the United States to that of Europe, you see, we spend there's a fraction in terms of how much we charge people in terms of gas tax. That's why gasoline is $5 a gallon in Europe and $1.20 here.
Yeah, but the difference is that in Europe, the gas taxes are not drawn off specifically to build roads. They're used; they're mostly put into general revenue places and used for a lot of different
things. But that has a lot of benefits. Taxing gasoline that heavily has a lot of social benefits in terms of transit.
If people are going to use it.
Hang on a second, Margie. We're not making a lot of progress on the point that you put here about the subsidies, but it's a message you want to get across to people like Nancy who are making these recommendations.
Yes, and well, like I said, I'm not a transportation economist and I don't have the numbers at my fingertips, but I think that there's a lot of chicanery going on when people, you know, throw their figures up and back, left and right about this, and that somebody should come clean and make a really good comparison. Somebody just brought up the trucks, and I remember back in the Reagan administration when he changed the weight limits on the big 18-wheelers, and now suddenly those trucks were doing phenomenally more damage to the roadbeds per passenger mile, per truck mile, than anything else that was out there before it. And we acted like, oh, that's no difference. There's no real extra cost there.
Margie, I'm going to cut you off here because I need to try and close out the conversation on Amtrak, but I thank you for bringing your passion and your point to the program today. Nancy, back to you. You did acknowledge that your Reform Council report is a starting point for a conversation. Where do you see it ending up?
I hope that it begins to press the Congress to take this issue seriously, to come clean, as Margie just said, about the numbers, and in fact begin a strategy. It's going to be a long-term strategy. We're not proposing any of this happen overnight. There's a lot of decision points that need to be fully explored by, you know, everybody, but certainly the Congress is a starting point, and I hope within the next year and a half we're going to see a serious rail policy, a very balanced rail policy in this country.
Jonathan, you think that's going to come out of this?
I'm afraid not. I think if this report had been more balanced, then we might have had a chance of that. The problem is, having injected this privatization element, having taken an approach which is going to put off a lot of people, I think it's just going to allow Amtrak to stay the same.
But Jim, at least people are talking.
At least people are talking, and I think they're talking about privatization. I think that's the wrong thing to be talking about. But I think we have to look at Amtrak in the wake of September 11th, and we'll see the importance of rail travel, which is growing in America. People want an alternative.
Thanks to all of you for being with me today. Jim Motovalli is editor of E! The Environmental Magazine, author of Breaking Gridlock, Moving Towards Transportation That Works. Jonathan Richman, transportation expert, consultant, and author of The Private Provision of Public Transport. And Nancy Connery, transportation consultant and member of the Amtrak Reform Council. Earlier we talked with former Massachusetts Governor Mike Dukakis, who is currently the chairman of Amtrak. Our senior producer is Graham Smith. My name's Dick Gordon. This is The Connection. Well, my baby said she's traveling on the one.